Good evening, everyone. And I'd like to begin by just, again, thinking of Lama Marut, who has passed away now. I think all of you know that. And I want to thank Rick and Lindsay for the very beautiful event that they organized and orchestrated on Friday in Rockport. And it was just so moving. I know many of you were there. And so that was such a wonderful and joyous way to think about our dear friend who actually died within some few number of hours after that. And so it was, I can't help but think that he was, aware of what was going on. And it was just such a heartfelt experience. And so thinking of that theme again of, when somebody that is close to us dies, it really brings up in our practice these what are regarded as preliminaries. And so what I would like to just begin with is thinking about these preliminaries to our practice in two different ways. So the first of these is the very obvious one of impermanence. And so in Dzogchen and in Mahamudra, actually, the layout of the preliminaries is the same. And this is the way that you really go about preparing yourself to do Mahamudra meditation and Dzogchen meditation practice. You really imbue your mind with certain thoughts that make it very, very receptive to doing these types of practices. And the second of the common preliminaries in both systems is impermanence. And so Dujom Lingpa advises that if you are having problems coming to grips with the knowing that not only are you going to die, but the time of your death is uncertain, which is very, very critical. So it's if you just know that you're going to die, that's an abstraction, really. That can be it's not very challenging to think that sometime in the future I'm certain that I'm going to live to be 96 because that's how old my grandfather was, and he went to the hospital once at the end of his life with pneumonia and then died. So I know that that's the way that I'm going to go. How comforting with that delusion, right? But the thing that is a lot more challenging is to really come to grips with the fact that you don't know, as Tibetans say, what comes next, my next life or the bottom of this cup of tea. And so when you really, really get that as basically whenever the thought arises in your mind about death, you have this knowing, you have a realization that it could happen at any time. It could happen on the way home, or it could happen even during the middle of this class. Stranger things happen all the time so that they're not even strange anymore, right? You get a large enough sample and all kinds of weird things happen. Manholes come through through the windshield of a car and kill a young woman on her way home from school in Boston a few years ago, right? A manhole coming through your windshield. So get a large enough sample, and every weird thing that is possible is going to happen. So that's one way. And Dujom Lingpa says that if you are having trouble coming to that realization that your own death, the time of it, is uncertain and could happen at any time, just look around you. And look at people around you dying, and probably for almost everyone, it's a surprise. Because the death process begins, according to Dzogchen practice anyway, when you get the diagnosis of a terminal illness. So that is the beginning of the bardo of death. And so whenever you get that diagnosis, the news that you have a terminal illness, and so Lama Marut got this fairly recently. Before that, it was just, some uncertain illness. But then it was discovered fairly recently that, this was going to kill him. So it's always a surprise. And if we are having problems with the realization that the time of our death is uncertain, just open your eyes and look around, and you'll see that this is the case for everyone. And it will bring this, and then you reflect on it, and there are ways of doing this that we've covered in other settings, particular analytical meditations, etc., that you can use to come to that realization. So that is thinking of one of the benefits of, you know, reflecting on death, is that it helps to inspire our practice. And the other thing that is so beneficial, and you can think of as a preliminary also, is that all of these practices are preliminaries for death. This is especially true for Dzogchen and Mahamudra, where what we are trying to do is to become lucid in the waking state and even lucid in deep dreamless sleep. So if you are able to achieve these standards of meditation here in your own practice, then you are so well prepared for actually dying, and you might actually welcome the opportunities that are present to you in the bardos that come after the death process and after the bardo of dying. And so, for instance, if you can reach this very high point of shamatha, stability and vividness, where you are lucid during deep dreamless sleep. So this is what will happen with the attainment of shamatha. So you're basically lucid 24 hours a day at that point. But even in deep dreamless sleep, you then will be aware. You won't lose awareness any longer. And so this is the reason for doing that is it's not just a sport or something that you can brag about to your tulku friends, but this is preparation for the dark attainment or the black near attainment that happens during the bardo of dying. And so the point is that if you can practice with this motivation and with this intention, then if you are able to go through the entire death process lucidly, meaning that you don't lose consciousness even during this point where everyone else loses consciousness, then you have a great opportunity. It's just like lucid dreaming. There are two ways of becoming of lucid dreaming, basically, or being lucid in a dream. One is to wake up during the midst of a non-lucid dream, and the other is to be lucid in deep dreamless sleep, and then you start dreaming lucidly. And so imagine going through the death process then, where you are totally aware through the dark attainment, and what comes after that then is the clear light of death. So you don't have to then try to become lucid in the midst of this non-lucid dream, but you will be fully aware that of the entire process when it arises. So this is some bardo instruction. So just for all of us thinking about what we are preparing for, this is the kind of bardo instruction that hopefully you will be familiar with at the time of your death and long before your death, be familiar with the kind of practices that lead to what is called recognition during the bardo, the transition phases after death, and that perhaps you will be also fortunate to have somebody who is a very experienced guide guide you through these processes as you are experiencing them in the bardo. So this is and this is actually one of the most extraordinary texts that I know of, that of bardo instructions. And so there are a number of different texts, what's called the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Total, various translations of that. But this actually, and these instructions actually come from Dujom Lingpa's Vajra Essence. And so these are the words and the advice of Samantabhadra himself about actually what comes during these phases. And so just a few lines, and you'll find these in your handout. And this is what someone would, and you should be familiar with, because this is going to have what comes after the bardo of dying is called the bardo of dharmata, or dharmata is ultimate reality. And so the point of what you are trying to do is recognize clear light. And so this is the advice that you would hear then from a guide as you were going through that point, which would be, could be, you know, somewhere around 3 days or so. It varies with the level of attainment of a practitioner, but between 1 and 3 days, depending on how long they stay in the dark attainment, etc. Could be as few as a few hours, as little as a few hours, up to about 3 days for the dark attainment, for instance. And then you could stay in the bardo of dharmata for anything from, you know, very, very brief, up to 21 days or something like that if you're a very advanced practitioner. But when you come to this point, the child clear light in which you have trained previously and the subsequently arising mother luminosity converge. As a result, like a child unhesitatingly crawling into its mother's lap, when your consciousness enters into the clear light, you will achieve liberation in the great bliss of union. And so this is what you are training to do with the rest of your life, basically, is to recognize exactly what this clear light, the experience of clear light, actually is like. So, and this training that you're doing and the experiences that you have of it, the glimpses that you have of it in your Dzogchen and Mahamudra meditation practices, and you get those, so, and everybody gets those. It's no great deal, you know. That is the child clear light. So you really familiarize yourself with that child clear light. So when the mother clear light arises during this great opportunity, right in the bardo of dharmata, you recognize it and you crawl into the lap of the mother clear light, and then you achieve liberation right there. So the bardos present extraordinary opportunities for enlightenment, and the key word is always in almost all of these texts is recognition. So you recognize the clear light, you recognize also some of the lights and other alluring signs that could lead you to other places that you wouldn't want to be reborn. But it's recognition. So you want to recognize what's going on. You want this to be a lucid dream in the bardo. And so after the bardo of dharmata, which perhaps if you don't... Well, for sure, if you don't recognize the clear light, you then move on to the next phase of the six bardos, which is the bardo of becoming. So this is the bardo that everybody thinks of as the bardos. So this is the one that can last then from anywhere from day three to through the 49th day or so. So this is the long one. And here, then basically the whole goal is to become like lucid dreaming so that you know what's going on. And you recognize all of these appearances as your own dream appearances, because they are going to be so convincing and they will be so alluring or so terrifying. And if you recognize them for what they are, then you have a possibility for waking up there. So this is the instruction for that phase, or there, you know, this is a very small segment of that, but this is what somebody would be guiding you three times a day for the period of from day three to day seven, anyway. You would hear this. Your own appearances are manifesting in the nature of clear light, great bliss. So recognize this. Merge there, transfer there, and find confidence. Hold your own ground on the basis of this confidence, and without being distracted by anything else, if you hold your own ground without delusion, you will become enlightened as a Sambhogakaya in the intermediate period. Do not be afraid of your own appearances as the wrathful mandala. Do not be terrified of your own sounds that appear to you. Do not fear the variously appearing light rays, but remain firm in the recognition of the ground pristine awareness as displays of the consummation of samsara and nirvana, and expand without limit. So recognize that all of these appearances are your own appearances, that they are not something that is happening to you in some horrific realm. And doesn't this sound like exactly what we're trying to do in our meditation practice, is to wake up and recognize that all of these appearances are our own appearances. So here is advice on how to practice Dzogchen from that same text. So this is the this dialogue that occurs between Samantabhadra and then this group of extraordinary apparitional disciples. So the faculty of luminosity asks, "O teacher, Bhagavan, if they are not established as being real, but are unreal in that way, from what do all phenomena arise and appear? May the teacher explain." He replied, "O faculty of luminosity, grasping to an identity acts as the primary cause, and conceptualization acts as the contributing condition, due to which phenomena emerge as mere appearances. Without the sense of self introduced by afflictive mentation, also called the eye maker, which is in Sanskrit ahamkara, without this sense of self, no appearance can arise. This causal grasping at identity occurs at a primeval level. The conceptualization that follows is secondary. Through the combination of these two, the primary cause and the contributing condition, all appearances manifest." So there you have it again. It is this. This is what we are trying to do in our meditation practice of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, is to recognize exactly that all appearances are actually displays of my own pristine awareness, and to not be terrified or freaked out or feel aversion for the ones that are unpleasant, and not feel grasping and attachment to the ones that are pleasant and want to keep them around. Because what are they after all? If you see these for what they are, as dream appearances and temporary dream appearances, then there's no reason to be either attached or to be feeling terrified by these appearances in basically what is essentially a dream. So this, you're not going to develop that insight and that realization with shamatha alone. And that is why vipassana practice or insight practice is so essential, to bring these two together in the fusion of shamatha and vipassana, to have the realizations that are going to prepare you for one, possibility of liberation in this life before you die, but secondly, if not, to be very well prepared for what awaits after death. And so the classic progression is that, first of all, you achieve shamatha, and then you work on vipassana practice. And so we went through just a very, very brief, wouldn't even call it a progression of shamatha, because it was just the very start of shamatha in the last week, of working with a visual appearance and finding the non-conceptual state, basically, because this is in Dzogchen and Mahamudra. What we are really aiming for is non-conceptuality, and this is the stillness of the mind that we are looking for. And you get a glimpse of that with the very first of the progression, the series of meditations in this progression, that is the very basic. First of all, with intention, you focus only on the single sense field of sight, the visual sense field, and then just with with bare attention, with bare visual awareness, you are just aware of this, whatever is in front of you, and recognizing whenever conceptual elaboration arises. So if you are able to do that, and it's not so easy to do without some practice, because what we are habituated to doing is constantly filling our mind with stimulation, and our mind is constantly flying off to some conceptual stimulation. So we are always either identifying, conceptualizing, categorizing what it is that we're looking at, or if we are able to not do that, what happens is that the mind just becomes bored and goes flying off to think of the impeachment inquiry or Halloween coming up or something else, some other form of haunting. So the reason for developing shamatha first is that the stability, the single-pointedness that you achieve with shamatha then allows these insights that you have about the nature of phenomena and the nature of your own mind to become stable. And this is what Master Kamala Shila said in his second stages of meditation. With bare insight that lacks serenity, which is shamatha, the yogi's mind is distracted by objects. Like an oil lamp in the wind, it will not be stable. For this reason, what sublime wisdom sees will not be very clear. And we all have that experience. So we all know emptiness, theoretically, intellectually, conceptually. We all have probably had experiences of emptiness, directly, non-conceptually. We've had experiences of non-duality, but they're brief. You know, they don't last. Just because you have a glimpse of it, unfortunately, without the stability and vividness that comes with this really stage development of shamatha, all of the insights that we have are going to be temporary. And in fact, the epitome of temporary happens during the bardo of becoming, where at one point, right at the very end, well, actually, I think this is actually right at the very end of the bardo of Dharmata, that all of a sudden, all the Dharma that you have ever heard comes back to you, and you forget it instantly. And then remarkable Dharma that you have never heard before, all of a sudden comes to you, and it so inspires you, and you forget it instantly. So this is exactly, we have these insights, but because our mind is not conditioned to the single-pointedness of shamatha, that we forget it very quickly. So one reason for this fusion of shamatha and vipassana is to make, shamatha makes vipassana stable. But also, we wouldn't want to just wait until we achieve shamatha before we concern ourselves with vipassana, because vipassana makes shamatha stable also. We can have a very good stretch of meditation, especially if you are, you know, isolate yourself in retreat and you aren't aware of what's going on in the world and you have nobody to bother you except your own mind. All of a sudden then, mental affliction arises. And there goes your stability, your vividness, and mental affliction just takes over. So the role of vipassana practice for shamatha is that it really attenuates mental afflictions, because you see through whatever it is as a true cause of a mental affliction. So you see that this is just an appearance of mind, so why should you be so upset about it? And Dujam Lingpa, then in his text, Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, says that, in short, these practices from shamatha to luminous cognizant consciousness and the substrate consciousness, as taught previously, constitute the phase of taking the aspects of the mind as the path. So this is, in this particular presentation, basically you achieve shamatha and you have glimpses of pristine awareness, all in phase one. And this is the taking aspects of the mind as the path, all in this phase one. So, you know, very extraordinary things, breakthroughs are happening, obviously, in this phase one of eight phases. But he says, but as long as this, even though you've achieved shamatha and had glimpses of pristine awareness, but as long as this is divorced from the vipassana of knowing the nature of existence, this does not bring you even a hair's breadth closer to the path of liberation from the suffering of mundane existence and the path of omniscience that liberates from the two extremes. Thus, even if you strive diligently in these practices for a long time, this does nothing more than perpetuate samsara. So understand how your life will certainly have been spent in vain. So even if you achieve shamatha, and even if you have glimpses of pristine awareness, which I think a lot of practitioners would be satisfied and say with that, that's a life well spent. I think I can take the rest of my life off now. You know, and maybe I should become a superstar teacher or something, you know, because those are extraordinary achievements. But you will not have advanced one hair's breadth towards liberation without vipassana. So this is why we are going to not wait until we achieve shamatha also before we concern ourselves with vipassana, because we want to be able to, first of all, support our shamatha practice, but also we want to be able to attenuate mental afflictions and prepare ourselves for the bardos. So the Buddha was the original progenitor, you could say, of vipassana practice in the four applications of mindfulness. And he taught vipassana in the Four Noble Truths. These were his first teachings and the first turning of the wheel. And so in this first turning of the wheel, the big message was selflessness, and the selflessness of persons in particular, meaning the selflessness of the absence of an I that can be found in the body or the mind. And so in the sutra teachings, the approach to recognizing this selflessness, the absence of an I, is conceptual, and you really, and this is this approach is also a large part of many or several Tibetan traditions. Also, the sutra approach to studying emptiness, but it's largely conceptual, very elaborated. You learn a lot of arguments and debates, and you come to some conceptual understanding. And then hopefully at some point, the conceptual understanding that you have will turn into a non-conceptual direct experience. And the problem with that, so the value of that approach is that conceptuality is extremely precise, and it is very, very detailed, and it is just so beautiful, you know, all of the many different philosophical arguments and approaches to understanding emptiness. And the precision is absolutely elegant. The problem and the difficulty is with turning the non-conceptual or the conceptual experience that you have into a non-conceptual direct realization of that emptiness. And in fact, it's said in the sutra teachings that is so difficult that it takes a very, very long time. Three clusters of great countless eons. So, you know, it's a long, long time. You know, it's the expansion and contraction of the universe many multiples of times. before this approach is going to, the conceptual approach is going to lead to a non-conceptual direct realization. And this is exactly what Padmasambhava had in mind when this description or distinction between direct experience and conceptual experience, when he said in the Vipassana chapter in the text Natural Liberation, according to the custom of some teaching traditions, you are first introduced to the view, and upon that basis you seek the meditative state. So this would be the approach of the Geshe's, of the Kenpo's, largely of the Geluk tradition and Sakya tradition, very scholastic, very scholarly. And so you first of all learn the view and all the debates about emptiness, the really comprehensive view of Tsongkhapa, and then at some point, hopefully, you try to realize what you have memorized in meditation. But unfortunately, I think that what many people who go through the curriculum, 20 years of study in that way, never get around to retreats because they become very satisfied with what they have learned. But there's even a greater danger there. So Padmasambhava says that according to some traditions, you are first introduced to the view, and then on that basis you seek the meditative state. But this, he says, makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. So if you take this approach, you actually are hobbling yourself, the possibility, because your mind is so filled with conceptual understanding, and the conceptual mind is already dominating our experience of reality. So it just believes that it already understands and knows emptiness because of its very highly elaborated understanding. And then he says, in this tradition, which is his tradition of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, you first establish the meditative state. Then on that basis, you are introduced to the view. This profound point makes it impossible for you not to identify pristine awareness. Therefore, first settle your mind in its natural state. Then bring forth genuine shamatha in your mind stream and reveal the nature of pristine awareness. So what you have are the two choices. If you choose the conceptually elaborated path, it makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. And if you choose the meditation, the path of meditation before being introduced to the view, then it makes it almost impossible not to identify pristine awareness. So if you are interested in identifying pristine awareness, play the odds by first of all achieving the state of meditation that he's talking about here is shamatha. So in pointing out the Dharmakaya, when we get to Vipassana practice, so we kind of skipped through, I did skip through the shamatha section of Mahamudra in this text that I'm sampling from, pointing out the Dharmakaya by Wangchuk Dorje, the ninth Karmapa. So, we just did a few of the shamatha practices, but basically what the point of that is, with the recognition that you've had, in this tradition, a lot of shamatha instruction already. And so just assuming that you remember all of that and you're already advanced practitioners, and over the course of the week, you were able to really focus on stillness, because there are different approaches to shamatha, but this one that really focuses on stillness rather than movement is the one that, for right now, we really want to focus on. So the stillness means basically the total absence of conceptuality in your mind, and where there is no movement whatsoever of thoughts, and no thoughts appearing whatsoever. And this may sound like, well beyond what you're able to do. But when you do these meditations, you get periods of this. It's not that your mind is constantly conceptualizing. There are gaps between thoughts, and you recognize those gaps between thoughts as exactly the state, the stillness of mind that you would like to become more familiar. And then as you become more familiar with these meditations of stillness in shamatha, then your whole practice can become imbued with this stillness, and you can go through entire ghatkas and longer in this non-conceptual state. Where basically, the conceptual mind just is dormant. So we are going to be, in this particular presentation, in this text of the Ninth Karmapa, which is pointing out the Dharmakaya, there are basically 10 different steps that you can go through in the Vipassana practice. And so we're going to concern ourselves with 4 of those steps. And so they deal with the very familiar subjects that you know of stillness and motion. And so first of all, we are going to be looking at stillness, or looking at the mind in stillness. And then the second is, so there are, in this Mahamudra tradition, first of all, you look at the mind and you just observe and be present with your experience of what it is that you're observing when you're looking at the mind, either in stillness or in movement. And then you get pointing out instructions that help you to deepen your experience and to really fathom what you are experiencing. Try to understand more deeply what it is that you are looking at and what you're getting out of this experience. So to look at something is very, very different than analyzing or conceptualizing or thinking about. So it is in the same way that we looked at a visual object right in front of us, and with the goal of bare attention, simply one single sense field, engaging this object with just a single sense field rather than conceptual elaboration. We are going to be doing the same thing now with this still mind. So we first of all bring the mind to stillness with our shamatha practice, and then we examine what is the nature of this mind that is still. So it's very simple, very direct. It is present, and it is the opposite of analysis of conceptualizing. So we are going to begin our practice by looking at the mind within stillness. And let's just say that this is your best approximation of the stillness that of shamatha, the achievement of shamatha, when the conceptual mind goes dormant, where there is only non-conceptuality and luminosity. And because of that non-conceptuality and luminosity, you have this experience of bliss. Also, that experience of non-conceptuality and luminosity is a very, very pleasant experience. So you basically rest in this non-conceptuality and luminosity of substrate consciousness, and then this is the stillness of the mind, and then we begin to ask questions about that. Vipassana practice explores this identity of I. You could say generic Vipassana practice explores whether we can find this I in either the body or the mind. And so we know what's at stake right now, because it is because of this I, this primeval innate sense of I am a subject, and all appearances are object that are appearing to me as the subject. All of these appearances are other than me. This is the way that things naturally appear to us. And so it is because of that that appearances arise at all. And Samantabhadra said that this is the primary condition, that this sense of I am the subject, because of I, there is an other. And this is then the way that appearances arise to us. And then we mistake those appearances to be truly existent, something truly other than my mind. And so what we need to do is to see through those in order to eliminate the root cause of mental afflictions and to eliminate the delusion that keeps us circling in samsara. And so Wangchuk Dorje, in pointing out the Dharmakaya, in a later section, has these four recognitions. And this is something that I have introduced for the last several retreats. So this will probably sound familiar. He says that now all objective appearances are like water and waves. All are apparitions of the mind and in reality are unestablished. By realizing this, one recognizes all appearances as the mind. So this is a list of things that you recognize as you are cutting through to pristine awareness. So this is a way of linking fusion of shamatha and vipassana. But what you're doing is recognizing that all appearances are the mind. And then secondly, he says, by analyzing the essence of the mind in terms of going, staying, and arising, it turns out not to be established as anything. So like horses and elephants in a dream, it is unestablished in reality. By realizing this, the second thing you realize is that the mind is empty. So first of all appearances are mind, and then you recognize that the mind is empty. And then Gyatso Rinpoche, in his commentary to that, says that when we recognize that the mind is primary, that all appearances are mind, there is a temptation to say that, so this mind then must be self-existent. Maybe this is the only truly existent thing that there is. Maybe this is who I am, the ultimate. So I go through the elimination of all the possibilities in the sutra approaches to vipassana. Can I find I in the body? Can I find I in appearances that are appearing to the mind? So it comes down to, finally, what about the mind itself? Is that self-existent? So this is the one then that in Dzogchen practice and in Mahamudra, we need to cut through, because this mind is the all-creating sovereign. The mind creates all phenomena, creates all appearances. So in Dzogchen, the reason that this is said to be so powerful and so fast, actually, is because if we can cut through this belief and the view that the mind is self-existent, that the mind has a substantial existence, then automatically we cut through the self-existence of everything that is created by the mind. So we're going right for the vulnerability and the Death Star in terms of point, you know, one of those in the series of Star Wars. You find the vulnerable spot in this otherwise invulnerable death ship, and you go right for that, and then, because there's only one huge vulnerability, and you go right for that. And here it is, what we're going to do is examine the nature of the mind itself. So this is exactly what characterizes Dzogchen and Mahamudra practice and distinguishes it from all of the other Tibetan Buddhist and all other Buddhist practices, is that you go right for this, the self-existence of the mind itself. And you do it not by conceptualizing, not by analysis, but you do it directly. You do it by observing the mind and then just looking at it and then letting the emptiness of the mind reveal itself to you. So there are, Vipassana always involves an inquiry. And these, so here there are a series of questions that we're are introduced. And so the in the classic approach to Mahamudra, what would happen is that a student will come to the guru in his cave and get some instruction, and then and basically will be given a, and the instruction will be a question to go back, for the student to go back to his or her cave and then meditate on this question and let the answer simply reveal itself while you are observing with this single-pointedness of shamatha. And so you get into this state of stillness and then just observe the mind with this question in the background. And there are a series of seven different questions in this particular pointing out the mind of in stillness. And then you just, and the point is that you are doing this non-conceptually to the best of your ability. You are just looking at the mind and seeing what you see and letting that be your entire meditation, just looking without expecting to see something, without wanting to see something in particular, without demanding that you recognize emptiness, but you just see what the mind is presenting to itself, what is presenting to you, to quote you, and then, you know, draw your conclusions from that. And then you go back to, after you have some experience, then you go back to the guru again, you describe what you experienced, and then the guru then would give you some pointing out instructions about your experience so that you can enrich your observation with the nature of what you have been doing. And you go through this whole series of questions then, and then you arrive at a direct experience of knowing the nature of the mind. So we will approximate that in this meditation. So find a comfortable position, and we will observe the mind, and I will ask you a few questions about what you are observing. So these practices within the Dzogchen tradition of Dujam Lingpa always begin by settling the body, speech, and mind in their natural states. And this natural state of the body is the state that you discover when the body is free of tension, when the body is free of agitation or constriction. The absence of tension is relaxation. It is not something that you do, but something you discover when tension is released. So simply allow your awareness to scan your body. And wherever you discover tension in the jaw, around the eyes, in the neck, wherever it may be, let your breath be drawn to it as if that tension is doing the inhalation. And then release that tension on the exhalation. releasing it into space. And continue to deepen your relaxation with each exhalation. While you maintain the clarity that you begin your meditation with. So don't give in to the habitual association of deep relaxation and drowsiness. And then settle the speech in its natural state, which is a state of effortless silence. And then settle the mind in its natural state, a state of luminous, spacious awareness that is able to illuminate appearances without becoming them, without being set in motion. Spacious, still, and luminous. Now, in this non-conceptual state, if your eyes are closed, open them. And gaze directly ahead at you. And simply be aware of whatever it is that is in front of you with only the visual consciousness, without identifying what it is that you see, without elaborating it conceptually. And simply recognize how relaxed the mind is that is able to maintain this engagement. It is not as if you clench this object, grip it tightly. The mind must be relaxed and receptive and present. Also recognize the experience of non-conceptuality. In the experience of only the seen, conceptual consciousness is dormant. And now lower your gaze, keeping your eyes open, without your gaze landing on anything in front of you, but just kind of dissolving in space, unfocused, the standard gaze of shamatha practice. And then hear these words of the great Vijayadhara, Yangtang Rinpoche. With the cessation of thoughts, you rest with no object, but examine very closely this mind that remains in the absence of thoughts. So what you are observing is actually the mind that is still. And look at it directly, without any expectation of what you might see. Place your mind in single-pointedness, vividly. And now here is a new instruction from the Shamatha text. With Vipassana practice, raise your gaze. First of all, to level, and then above level. So your eyes are actually elevated. You're not gazing to the left or the right, but you are gazing directly in front of you, but your gaze is elevated. So you are still observing the stillness of your mind, the non-conceptual experience of stillness. But with your eyes elevated now, your gaze elevated, ask this question. Does this mind that is still, does it have a form? Does this still mind have a shape? Does it have a color? Is it something you can actually see? Again, look at it directly for your information. What you are looking at is the stillness of your mind. Does this still mind have any substantial characteristics? Does it have a size? Does it have a location in space? Does this stillness of mind, the mind that is still, as you are observing it, does it have any substantial characteristics? And now lower your eyes again and take a break back into shamatha practice. Simply rest in non-conceptuality. The Vipassana advice is to do it in short bursts or periods. And rest again in shamatha before you fatigue yourself. Rest in this vivid stillness. Simply observe it. And then elevate your gaze again. And ask, this awareness that is still, if it is something substantial, this mind, it must have started at some point. Where did it come from? Can you observe the process of this mind coming from somewhere else? Was it something somewhere else? Or was it nothing nowhere? How does something nothing nowhere become something here that you can observe? Where does this mind come from? This mind of stillness. Maybe this will be easier because this mind is present right in front of you. You are engaged with it. It is present. So where is it? Where is this still awareness located? If it is a substantial entity, can you find it? Is it inside your skull? Somewhere else in your body? Is it outside of your body? Where is it located? And you will certainly have noticed that this stillness of mind doesn't last forever. Where does it go? As you're watching it, origin, location, destination. Over and over again, these are the questions. Where did it come from? Where is it? Where does it go? Does it vanish right where it is? Does it withdraw to a single point and then disappear? Then lower your gaze and relax the questioning again. Relax into the single-pointed vividness, non-conceptual, this luminous, spacious mind. Then elevate your gaze again. While you continue to observe this mind that is still, that is non-conceptual. And then as Kacho Wangpo says, place your present mind vividly in single-pointedness. Observe the nature of that which is placed. How does it exist? If you think it does not exist at all, who is it that apprehends this absence? Is that a realization of your own mind or not? And if you think when I look for it, it doesn't appear, observe that thinker and also observe that observer. If nothing can be observed with substantial characteristics while you rest in stillness, does that mean that there is no mind whatsoever? If so, what is it that came to that conclusion? Or is your experience when you look at this an absence of awareness altogether? A total vacuity. Or when you observe this stillness, do you have the experience that there is something rather than nothing? There is a state of lucidity, luminosity, the capacity to know. Then relax the inquiry again and rest simply in spacious, luminous awareness. So when you looked at this mind in stillness, what did you experience? Anybody have something to venture, to offer? Was there something there? So this is the big question. And this is the whole point of that. Why do they keep going back to what seem like such routine, rudimentary questions? Origin, location, destination, shape, size, the mind. Does it have, as we are looking at it and experiencing it directly, does it have any of these substantial qualities, any of these substantial properties? Did anybody find a mind with color? Did anybody not find a mind with color? What about a mind with size? Does it have a shape? Is it a sphere? You know, are you in the center of a sphere? All of these things, you know, we kind of operate as if this mind is substantial, if it has substantial qualities and characteristics. My mind is so unruly today. My mind is heavy. My mind is blue. You know, all the time we operate as if this mind of ours has substantial qualities, as if it is something that is a basis of designation. I can call that me because it is a thing that exists as something independent of me, some independent autonomous essence. So that is the whole point. Can we actually examine the stillness of awareness? And we're starting with stillness actually because it's easier than the mind in motion. So this stillness when there is nothing there but pure awareness. How does it exist? And we would say that it doesn't have any qualities that I can find. It doesn't have any shape. It doesn't have anything that indicates that it has a substantial existence. Any of those properties. And it's easy to say those words. And in fact, in the seventh way of experiencing, it is called something that to the patch of concepts. And this is what Gampopa, the great Mahamudra master, said, that is, it is confusing understanding and experience. So this is probably one of the most common experiences in doing Vipassana practice, is that we let the practice become conceptual and we talk ourselves into having an experience because we know the answer. You know, we have taken the approach that, frankly, in most of our Buddhist education, that Padmasambhava says makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. It's because we already know the answer. It is non-dual luminosity and emptiness. So we start looking for that. And we think, I've experienced that. There it is, right there. So this is a conceptual patch that we are putting onto our experience. And so the task, actually, and this is not something that you do one time and expect to have a realization, because what you do is, as Khandro Rinpoche said, the advice from her Tulku father was to simply wear out the cushion, wear out cushions, right? Her father told her when she was a young girl, I have worn out more cushions than you have worn out shoes. And this is the way that you go about Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice, is that it is so simple. You don't overlay your experience with expectation, with concepts, and then confuse the concepts for experience. This is the trap that the conceptual mind lays for us. And so it is simply, the task is to, in the same way that you can be aware of when you are looking at a visual object in front of you, you can be aware of the instant that you are overlaying a conceptual interpretation or a conceptual experience of this thing. It feels entirely different. And the bliss of the presence also goes as soon as the conceptual mind begins to engage with the object rather than the presence of simple, unelaborated visual appearance. So it's tricky, and you just to avoid that conceptual, basically talking yourself into the experience and then moving on. Okay, I've got that now. What's the next thing in Mahamudra? That was so easy. Shape, location, origin, destination, presence, all of these things. Are you trying to talk me into the fact that the mind has substantial qualities? Well, of course it doesn't. I know that. But do we really? So is the mind the brain? In this culture, what is the common answer? It, of course it is. What else could it be? What do you think, that there is something other than matter? This is what the Tibetans were getting at for millennia, actually, is that the mind is primary and it is not matter. It is not an emergent property of matter. It is not an epiphenomena. It is mind. It is insubstantial. It has no substantial qualities that you can discover? And how do you come to have an experience of that, a direct experience of that, that has the power to actually liberate you from the confusion and duality that keep us locked in the conceptual mind and a conceptual experience of our own minds? It's simply looking without expectations, without presuppositions, without knowing the right answer, but just looking and looking and looking and looking and letting the mind, because what you are looking at is the nature of the mind right there in front of you, and just let it reveal itself to you. So the pointing out instructions then ask also, so does that mean then, if it has no substantial qualities, that there's nothing there? Well, again, you need to experience the absurdity of that for yourself. Well, if there is nothing there, if I can't find any substantial qualities, does that mean that there's nothing there? Well, then, who is it that is asking the questions? Who is it that's having the experience? Who is it that is coming to that conclusion that there is nothing there? Of course, there is a mind there. So there is something there. But that something is not a thing that you can observe that has qualities, substantial qualities. So what do you come up with?
Awareness.
Yeah, and what is this awareness? Awareness is actually what we're watching. You know, only awareness, so non-conceptual, still, spacious awareness. What is it? What is that awareness? So, and again, what is the experience of it? Was there an experience of even when there? So here's the question for you. Does the knowing capacity of awareness, which is simply in Tibetan Buddhism, in Dzogchen Mahamudra, this is called the luminosity of the mind. The luminosity of the mind, the knowing quality, the capacity of the mind to know, does that depend on conceptuality? Or can you experience that knowing capacity of the mind, the luminosity of the mind, even when there is no conceptuality? So this is what you are left with. You could say there is an emptiness of substantial qualities and characteristics. The mind is not inherently existent, because if it were inherently existent and existed as a thing, then it would have qualities and characteristics that we could know it by. It must, by definition. But we can't find any of those. So does that mean that nothing is there? Well, there is this luminosity, this sense of knowing. And so are these two incompatible? The luminosity and emptiness. Is emptiness, so this is perhaps something, again, something that you have to come to experientially rather than conceptually, because if you were like me, you had many years of conceptual education that told you that emptiness is a sheer absence. And the emptiness of the mind is an emptiness. So when you experience emptiness, you are experiencing a sheer absence. It's not that you pass out or go blank, but there is nothing. There is an absence of all objects and all attributes. So is this emptiness then a nothingness, a sheer absence? Or is it the absence of any qualities that you can find that define it as a substantial entity? And that what you are left with then is this non-duality of luminosity and emptiness. They are inseparable, this luminosity and emptiness. And this is what your guru then would point out to you when you go back to him with your observations. And he keeps directing you, trying to lead you to this point where this becomes your experience. When you are resting in this observing the still mind of shamatha, it is empty of being a thing, empty of having any tangible qualities, but it is not a nothingness because it is radiant with this capacity for knowing, the luminosity. Yes, Brett.
In previous teachings, you talked about spontaneous actualization. Would this be a spontaneous, would that apply to this kind of merger of the two?
So the spontaneous actualization is actually what emptiness refers to in Mahamudra and Dzogchen. So emptiness is not nothingness. And emptiness, in fact, is because of emptiness, everything can arise. And spontaneous actualization is the arising that is what makes appearances knowable. So appearances arise out of emptiness because emptiness is not a sheer absence. Emptiness is the potentiality, the sheer potentiality. So yes, that is exactly what it is. That union of luminosity and emptiness is spontaneous actualization, or makes that possible exactly. And so this is what we are trying to recognize, is the quality of the mind, because what we are, the trap that this is intended to cut through, this is trekchu practice, cutting through. And what we are cutting through is the last vestiges of identity and subject and object duality that exists when you achieve shamatha. So even in this non-conceptual state, and even in this state when you're resting in substrate consciousness, which is, you could say, above the point where klishtamanas, or afflicted mentation, says, I am, and because I am, other exists. And when that happens, then you have that basic bifurcation. That's what Samantabhadra said makes all appearances possible. So when you're resting in shamatha, even above that basic bifurcation, there still is this sense of, there can be either a grasping to the luminosity and non-conceptuality and bliss, because it is so pleasant. What could be better? You've just, been afflicted with mental afflictions and conceptuality for countless eons, and now you are resting in non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. What could be better? So this is exactly what, during the time of the Buddha, that practitioners ran into, because they thought that this was moksha, that this was liberation. So you can easily become attached to that. And this is the way then that you actually cut through the that trap of remaining stuck in shamatha, basically, and having the experience that Dujam Lingpa described of not advancing one hair's breadth towards liberation, because you haven't inquired about the nature of that mind in stillness. So can you find substantial qualities? Are there substantial qualities to be attached to? Or is it only luminosity, non-conceptuality, and existing, and the two of those, emptiness and luminosity, existing simultaneously and non-dually? And this then becomes the your experience when you actually do cut through then to pristine awareness. And you go from the state then when there have been no appearances, you've been resting in this state because of shamatha, where there are no appearances, and then all of a sudden you cut through and then appearances arise again, but they are, you're not experiencing them in the same way because now you are experiencing them from the point of pristine awareness. And now you see all appearance as mind. You see them as creative displays of awareness itself. You see mind is empty. So it is not that appearances are empty, but mind is real. Mind is empty also. But mind is not nothingness. Mind is not simple absence. Mind is this spontaneous actualization that all appearances arise spontaneously. You don't do anything to call them out. They just arise from the nature of the mind itself. And then all of these appearances that arise spontaneously also self-release. They dissolve back into the space of the mind from which they arose. So that is the mind in stillness and the potential of that. And the point of the practice is not to trick yourself into thinking that it's difficult or that it is the mind, the nature of the mind is somehow difficult to observe, because it is right there in your ordinary moment of every perception. And so you just strip it down and watch the mind in stillness when it's not doing anything. And that is going to be relatively easy compared to the mind in motion, I think, anyway. So next week, then we will go into the shamatha practice that will set us up for doing the vipassana practice in the fourth week. So next week we will do the shamatha practice of how to remain still, how to maintain a stillness of awareness, even with observing a mind in motion. And that is the simultaneous stillness and motion of Dujom Lingpa's practice of the four modes of mindfulness. And very exhilarating practice that is has endless applications in our daily lives of maintaining stillness even in the presence of constant agitation and even mental afflictions. Conceptuality arises even while you're balancing your checkbook, paying your taxes, having a conversation with someone. You can still maintain a stillness of awareness in the midst of this movement of the mind. And that, so we'll get familiar with that, the mind in motion, you know, what is, so that we can observe it, this mind in motion. And then we will do, on the fourth week, we will do a very elegant series of vipassana inquiry into the nature of the mind in motion. So wear out the cushion this week, but don't trick yourself into thinking that this is an unattainable object to look at, that it's somehow far away or distant. And don't think that you have to somehow fix what you're seeing, change what you're seeing, or be dissatisfied with what you're observing. Simply observe what you are seeing truly without overlaying any conceptions or projections onto it, and let that reveal itself. Let the nature of the mind reveal itself to you, without relying on analysis or conceptuality. And that is the experience that has the power to transform your life, transform your perceptions, and to lead to liberation. So that's the promise. So enjoy your week. Thank you, Rick, once again, for setting us up here. And so we'll see you again next week, I hope, at this time. Okay, so this is a very great mass of merit that you have created with your motivation, because our motivation is not only that may I be free of my own mental afflictions, but I know that if I can do it, if I can cut through this delusion of subject and object, I know that I can show others how to do this. So by the goodness of what you have done, the power of your motivation, the dedication of your practice, may all beings find a path. May they find perfect guides on the path. And may they reach the culmination of the path so that suffering is eliminated from the world and all beings achieve the state of unsurpassed bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. May it be so by the goodness of what you have done.